to kiss it.
Hey, good afternoon again. This is Joe T with you, and in just a few minutes, Jimmy Clanton will be here. My goodness, we've been looking forward to this for a couple of weeks now, and wow, I am as excited as a kid on Christmas morning because my friend Jimmy Clanton, this will be my third interview with him, and he, let me tell you something, folks. Talk about a legendary performer and recording artist. You've got the top of the list right here with Mr. Jimmy Clanton. He'll be here at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. And hey, we're going to play some tunes by Jimmy to get you warmed up.
Each other's lives.
Oh yeah, what a great version, huh? 1,000,000 to 1, Jimmy Clanton. My goodness, I just want to say hello to all of you who are in the chat room, and we will be having Jimmy with us in just a couple of moments. But I want to send out a big, huge thank you to my friend Sandy Weeks. Sandy is the executive associate for Jimmy Clanton Enterprises. So I'll tell you what, let's all put our hands together for Sandy. Yeah. Yeah, this all starts with Sandy. We have to get a hold of her and talk with her, and she puts everything together for us. So Sandy, from the bottom of my heart, I thank you for doing this. Right now, here's Jimmy, and wait. We don't have to wait too much longer.
I know that you'll be tempted to stray while I'm away. But baby, wait, wait, wait. My darling, wait, 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 wait for me. Wait. A simple guy who couldn't make you stay.
own true love. But yours,
no arms but yours,
will ever lead me through heaven's door.
Well, there we go, my friends, 1959, Jimmy Clanton, one of my favorites, his My Own True Love, and you will never guess who I have on the other end of this phone, the man who sang that song, Mr. Jimmy Clanton. Hi, Jimmy.
It's a pleasure to be with you and all your listeners. It really is, I'm very humbled. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, we appreciate having you with us. And we have had a lot of great comments. I've got some questions that folks want to ask you, and I've written them down. And you know, I was reading your background of coming up when you first started in the music business, and the name of your first group. What was that one, Jimmy?
Well, actually, when I was still junior, senior in high school, about three of us, three guys plus myself, we had a little group called the Dixie Cats, and we just kind of played in our neighborhood living rooms. That's about it. But really, right after I got out of high school and turned 18 years of age in Louisiana, you could go into a nightclub, places that served alcohol, nightclubs. You could go in there at age 18. And I had a fella approach me about joining his band. And make a long story short, I agreed to do that. And shortly thereafter, we began to have engagements in regular nightclubs and became really the number one white rhythm and blues swamp pop band along the Gulf Coast, and it was called the Rockets.
The Rockets, and was the fellow was Dick Holler?
Dick Holler. Dick Holler was a couple of years older than me. He had the contacts, and he realized the music was changing, and rather than just the four lads and four freshmen sound, people wanted kind of a more rock and roll rhythm and blues, and he knew he really needed that guitar in the band. And somebody told him that there's this white kid that just is an incredible guitar player. And so he actually hired me as a guitar player. It's a long story how I became a vocalist. That's a real long story. but eventually I became pretty much the lead singer for the Rockets. You want to hear that story or not?
Sure.
Okay. How much time do we have?
Jimmy, whatever time you got.
Oh, my gosh. Well, it's kind of interesting because I had played guitar just for a short period in a big band, and out of the clear blue, I was in the, taking a break, and I overheard just this part of a conversation. I heard this guy say, I heard the leader of this group tell this fellow, he said, well, I have to pay him $5 a night more because he sings. And I went, whoa, I never heard that. Now, we have to remember, $5 in 1957, that went a long way, you know what
sure
I mean?
Sure did, oh yeah.
I mean, you could fill up your gas, your car totally with gas for $5 back in that day. And anyway, so I remember that. So eventually, I went with the Rockets as a guitar player. And of course, Dick Holler, Dick did most of the all the singing in that day. And one day I said to him, I said, Dick, I said, look, you're going to get hoarse eventually doing all the singing all the time. I said, I wouldn't mind doing a couple of songs here and there. I said, but I just want to tell you that in the other band I played with, the guy that did some singing, he got an extra $5 a night more. So Dick kind of looked at me like, He said, well, I'll tell you what. He said, let's just see how it goes with the song. And he said, then we'll talk about the rest later. So I'll never forget, a song came out, and everybody's got to remember, in 1956-57, there was no such thing invented as a recording device. So we had to memorize our songs either from the radio or buying the record and memorizing it.
Mm-hmm.
And Arthur Neville, one of the Neville brothers from New Orleans, Arthur Neville came out with a song, and I loved it, and I memorized it. And I'm going to do a little bit for y'all.
Okay, great.
So Dick said, okay, so I went to him on this particular night of the engagement. I said, I'm ready to go ahead and let you hear what I sound like. Okay, so let me get a sip of water, y'all. Okay, so I taught the guys a song earlier. So I went up to the microphone, and I went right into that song, Ooh-wee, baby. Ooh-wee, baby, I love you so. Ooh-wee, baby, don't ever let me go. Fool that I am to think you could love me too. And the horns. Ooh-wee, baby, don't want no one but you. And I looked down into the audience, and everybody, including guys, everybody started gravitating down to the front of the stage. And for whatever reason, I'll never forget this. I looked down there, and this one guy looked over to a buddy next to him, and all I could do was read his lips, and he said, man, that guy can sing. Well, that did it. So I started making $5 a night more as really then becoming the lead singer of the Rockets.
There you go. Well, and I understood that when you were discovered, that the recording studio, now this was Ace Records, correct? And Cosmo, he owned the studio, right? He was a former jukebox operator, and he recorded you guys, and wasn't it something like $25 to go in for a recording
session? Well, actually, Ace Records did not own the studio. But Cosmo did, and Cosmo would rent out his studio for various record labels, including he recorded all of the Little Richard stuff. He recorded all of the Domino songs. And what had happened, a girl had said to Dick, Holler, said that a boy that I dated in a band said there's a recording studio in New Orleans, and for $25, they'll give you an hour recording time. So Dick came to me and the rest of the guys. He said, "What do you think about that? You know, just get an idea of what we sounded like together."
Mm-hmm.
So we went to Cosmos, but still at that time Dick was doing all the singing, so he was doing all his own original songs. So we were recording, and I was playing guitar, and all of a sudden, Dick said, "Okay." He said, "I don't have anything else. That's it." He said, "Jimmy, do you have anything?" I said, "Well, I wrote this little song, and I had been going with my girlfriend and my first love, and she and I were having a lot of arguments, and I ended up writing this little song about her called 'I Trusted You.'" And Dick said, "Well, you know, the guy, Cosmo, came on the sound system and said, 'You got 5 or 6 minutes. Do you have anything?'" And so I said, "Okay." So I put the song down and recorded it. So we all went back home to Baton Rouge. And about 10 days later, I guess it was, I got a phone call at my house.
Wow.
from a Cosmo studio. And this guy gets on the phone and he said, "Jimmy," he said, "my name is Johnny Vincent." He said, "I own a record company called Ace Records." And he said, "I just happened to hear this playback of a song that you did here in the studio, and I'd like to talk to you about it." So, make a long story short, of course, that got my attention, and not knowing what was going to happen, I drove to New Orleans. It was only about 90 miles away from my home. And the bottom line was, Johnny Vincent said, I like that tinny sound that you have." And he said, I like that song. You got that, it's that Louisiana swamp pop sound. And he said, I'd like to record you. He said, "But I don't want to record with your band. I want to record that song with you and all of the professional studio musicians." And so I agreed. And I said, "Well, the only catch is I don't want to leave my band." He said, no, you continue on with your band." So that worked out great. So we put that record out locally. And, of course, being the first local artist to have a song played on the radio, we had many, many gigs all over the Gulf Coast. So after about 5 months, Johnny called me back. He said, "Jimmy," he said, "it's really time to get back to the studio." And then he said, do you have any more songs you wrote?" I said, "What?
Yeah.
I'm not a songwriter. That was just an afterthought, you know."
Yeah.
And you know, it's amazing because when he said that, and he set a date for coming in the studio, I'm telling you, out of the clear blue, I'm in my living room with my guitar, and I'm just writing songs left and right. I mean, it was just a natural for me to songwrite. And one of the songs, so I go back to New Orleans, it's time to record, and we record a few songs. I said, "Okay, here's a ballad that I wrote," and I'll never forget this. Talk about a futuristic statement. The saxophone player started putting the music together, and we recorded this ballad, and after we recorded it, he said to me, "Now here's a guy that was the sax player on all the Fats Domino hits, all the Little Richard," and he looked over at me and he said, "That's a hit. That song happened to be Just a Dream." So within a short period of time, I'm still playing around Baton Rouge and all the Gulf Coast. And then he calls me out of the clear blue, Johnny Vincent, and he said, "I've got you a plane ticket." He said, "I'm sending you to Philadelphia." And he said, "There's a new show on," and he said, "It's really a big hit, and it's called Dick Clark and American Bandstand." So to make a long story short, I flew up to Philadelphia. Never been in an airplane, going to Philadelphia was like going to the planet Mars.
Sure.
To me, you know, that was another world.
Right.
And so I did that song. I did a lip sync on that. And the next day, I found out Johnny Vincent got orders for over 100,000 copies of Just
Wow.
a Dream the very next day after that appearance. And so, to say the least, within 10 days, I've got major people, promoters calling, wanting me to do shows, and I got a major booking agency in New York, the very top ones, called GAC, General Artists Corporation. I signed that contract. Alan Freed wanted me. Dick Clark wanted me. And it was just, wheels up, we're out of here. And I mean, I'm traveling all over America.
Wow. Yeah.
It was just unbelievable. Overnight.
Yeah, and you know, Jimmy, the amazing thing is just a dream. And of course, you know this, but I'm going to tell your fans. Just a Dream was a number 4 hit on the Billboard Top 100 and a number 1 hit record on the Billboard R&B charts. I mean, you did something that was almost unheard of.
You know, I didn't know that for a long, long time because I never read Billboard, and I didn't know those numbers. But then, in fact, I tell you who it was. It was amazing. I was doing a show years later after Just a Dream. I was doing a show with Johnny Tillotson.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking. Johnny said, "Man, I was so jealous of you." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I was just in Detroit." He said, for a show, and he said, "I found out in Detroit on the rhythm and blues stations there, and Billboard," he said, "that your song, Just a Dream, was number 1.
Wow.
And I thought, well, that, you know, for that to be rhythm and blues, as well as the pop charts, and it was just, I don't know, it was just a song for the ages for Jimmy Clanton, that's for sure, you know?
Well, I read that you... Bobby Rydell, Frankie Avalon, Fabian were like the top echelon of the late 1950s. And the word that came out on you was that Jimmy Clanton has soul. Jimmy Clanton can sell a song with his voice and not a lot of background with him, and that put you at the top run.
Well, I don't know what to say there. You know, I think I was truly born with a God-given talent, and one of the things that I had a talent for, and I never thought about this, is that I could really, with my voice, give whatever song I was singing, give it a real deep soul, a true expression of what the song was saying. And I was, you know, I just didn't do it in a Mickey Mouse style. I won't say who it is, but there was an artist that everybody would know the name. And I found out that he put out an LP of top 10 songs of whatever that year was.
Mm-hmm.
And he out and out redid and sang Just a Dream. And it was awful. And the reason it was awful is that he did not have the feelings of the background of that song. He was just singing words. And I appreciate you saying that because I've always really tried very hard to give expression to all my songs, whether it was just me copying somebody or my own records. But that was important to me to do that, you know?
Yeah. Now, the Ace recording company, now, compared to, like, you know, the RCAs and the Capitals and that,
right.
Did Ace do all of the distribution on your records?
Well, you know, now years later, it's easy for me to see that Johnny Vincent got into the record business, and right away he was over his head.
Mm-hmm.
I think the reason was he wanted to make a records with a few artists and just get local airplay and maybe, you know, maybe just local action on the radio stations. I don't think he had any idea that once he put out Huey, Piano Smith, and the Clowns with Rockin' Pneumonia and the Boogie Woogie Flu, which became a national hit, he realized he was in over his head, and so he just licensed out distribution rights to every Tom, Dick, and Harry because demand for the song was there, and he didn't know how to bring to fruition the total amount of sales that were being asked for. And even by the time Just a Dream and Jimmy Clanton came out, he still had that same problem. And what happened was, for example, you know, to me it's a crying shame. I'm over it now emotionally. But even like in Europe, in England, Venus in Blue Jeans, Another Sleepless Night, Just a Dream. These were huge hit songs, but not for me. They were covered by a guy named Mark Winter. I mean, he was smart. He found hit songs in the United States, and he would copy them in Europe. And he had like a top 10 hit with Venus in Blue Jeans in Europe.
Yeah. Wow.
But, you know, it's just something that Johnny Vincent did not have the expertise, and he did not have the manpower as Capitol, RCA, and some of these major labels, you know.
Yeah.
So it was what it was. You know, what can you say?
Well, you, for sure, you had 4 million selling single records that I know of. All right. The one that really amazes me, Jimmy, the most is Ship on a Stormy Sea. Now, the reason I'm saying that is because that record did not chart on the Billboard pop charts. How did you sell 1 million copies? Where did the record sell? I mean, it's a great tune, but how come it wasn't
sure
on the Billboard charts?
You never did any background on the Billboard Top 100 that Ship on a Stormy Sea never did? Wow.
I got the book right in front of me, and it didn't. No, it's not listed on there.
I'll be done. Well, it was the epitome of a swamp pop record, okay? If somebody would say to you, Jimmy, you're from down there, you say you grew up, And you recorded mostly a swamp pop. Swamp pop was a combination of rhythm and blues and rock and roll. With rhythm and blues, you had drums, guitar, piano, and a bass. And where rock and roll came in then, what's Andy? Okay. And where rock and roll came in, you had horns, like on Fats Domino
right,
had
yeah,
horns,
uh-huh,
Little
uh-huh.
Richard had horns. And so with the Rockets, we had full rhythm, and then we had two horns, six pieces. That's what really constituted a swamp pop band. And Ship on a Stormy Sea was the epitome of that, you know, the rhythm of it, the background girl singing it, and the horns on it. And it was a huge song because it also was a major song in the most iconic rock and roll movie ever made called Go, Johnny, Go.
There you
go.
That
was where pretty much the last scene of Go, Johnny, Go. And when I'm up on stage, Alan Freed had introduced me. The song that I did was Ship on a Stormy Sea.
You know, how about if we take a little break here for a second, and how about if I give Ship on a Stormy Sea a spin?
Okay,
Let's do it.
All right.
The love you gave me was what I need, but now it seems to fade from me. Now this love like a ship, oh yeah, in a stormy sea.
A stormy sea.
A gypsy woman, she read my palm. She said soon that you'd be gone. Yes, I'm sinking like a ship, oh yeah, in a stormy sea.
A stormy sea.
Everybody, everybody, everybody is somebody's fool. You know it, baby. You know it, baby. Yes, you know. You know it's true. My ship of love has sailed till now. Didn't take no chances, sunk anyhow. Threw my love like a ship, oh yeah, in a stormy sea.
A stormy sea.
Everybody, everybody.
my ship of love has sailed till now. Didn't take no chances, sunk anyhow. Threw my love like a ship, oh yeah, in a stormy sea.
A stormy sea.
Well,
man, you got into that song. It was unbelievable. And
well, yeah.
I've always been able to sing that kind of music, you know. So.
Well, yeah, you certainly did. We're back live right now with Jimmy Clanton, and we just listened to Ship on a Stormy Sea from 1959. I'll tell you, those songs were all you, man. You're doing it all. There's no background choir or chorus or whatever drowning you out. I mean, wow.
Thank you.
You know, not only do I spin the records, but growing up, you know, I was a fan of yours. In fact, I still got a big stack of your 45s. I was looking at them today, and I've even got one that's got a picture sleeve on it. How about that? Another Sleepless Night. I got that one with the picture sleeve. So, wow. I mean, it's just...
Thank you.
It's just amazing.
I got an interesting story about Another Sleepless Night.
All right.
I was doing a show in New York. I was backstage, and it was a big, big stage in the back there. And this guy comes walking up to me. He says, Jimmy, man, I just love that song you did, Just a Dream. And I wrote a follow up song for you, and it would be perfect for you. And I'm going, oh man, here we go. You know, everybody was pumping me. Everybody had a song for Jimmy Clanton. You know,
yeah.
And I was trying to slough him off, but he would take no for an answer. And finally, out of the clear blue, over in the corner of the back of this venue was a piano. And he said, just give me a minute. So he kind of like grabs me by the sleeve, pulls me over there, and he plays a little of this song. And I flipped out. Because it so was exactly how my voice, it just fitted me, you know?
Uh-huh.
I said, wow. I said, you know what? Man, this is a great song. And I ended up recording it. And the guy that was hounding me backstage was the guy that wrote it, Neil Sedaka.
I think we've heard of him. He had a couple of records during his time, didn't he?
Neil tells that story around the country himself on how he hounded Jimmy Clanton to record that song. Yeah.
Wow, that's quite a story. And that's a great tune. You've had so many live concerts during your career, and people have come to see you. Your fans really, really love you, Jimmy. And there's a friend of mine, a real good friend of mine, who was in the chat room this evening, and his name is Eddie. And Eddie wanted me to tell you how much he enjoyed seeing you in concert in St. Louis several years ago. And he said, thank you for all the great songs over these many years.
Well, thank you very much, Eddie. You know, the thing is about when we would do these tours, these shows with multiple acts, in order to keep those shows within a decent time of about 2 hours, most of the time I was limited to four songs at the most. You know, once in a while I do some concerts to where the promoters loved my music, and he would see to it that I did at least five songs of my repertoire.
Uh-huh.
But I always tried so hard to do a good job for the fans. You know, the thing that people don't realize is that. I don't know who tabbed that Teen Idol thing, but I've been told that when I was 18 or 19, 20 back, I was told that I was a pretty good-looking kid. And,
yes, you certainly
another,
were.
I attracted the girls, and some of these big shows I did, seriously, I could not get out of the dressing rooms. That we would have to wait until way after... the venue was closed and everybody went home before I could even get out of there to go back to the hotel. And the reason I'm telling that is you fast forward now 30, 40 years later. And so I enjoy going out and intermingling and being with the fans, you know,
mm-hmm.
and letting them know. I'm sorry that how many times they've come to see me, they never got a chance to talk with me or shake my hand or give me a kiss on the cheek. Or it was just amazing how that occurred as people were telling me that. So I made it my job. Everywhere I went, I would go out with my executive associate, Sandy Weeks, whom you all gave a big round of applause for.
Oh, yeah.
And I would go out and I would be there and I would meet and greet every fan that would want to take a minute to be with me.
Wow.
Because that was important. I mean, without fans, I would have had no career, period.
Well, you know, that is absolutely true. And there are some that don't really care to mingle with the fans. I'm sure that you have run into them yourself, you know?
I've run into some of those artists, and you know, it is what it is.
I
don't understand that, but that's not the way Jimmy Clanton is.
Well, I have a couple questions for you that a couple of my friends have asked. My friend Hal, he asked me, he says, many singers also play the piano. Does Jimmy play any other instrument? Now, I know that you play guitar.
I was strictly guitar. That was the instrument that I loved. And I spent many hours of my young age learning how to play it, teaching myself.
Right.
I taught myself. I bought a little 25-cent guitar chord book, taught myself chords. And then I found that if I would turn on the radio and play a song on the radio, I found within 6 to 8, 9 months, I could follow the chord progression of those songs.
Right.
And I just became really an expert guitar player. And I really treasure that, because the way I felt I became a really good songwriter is that because I could play guitar and I knew these beautiful chord progressions, I knew how to put those chord progressions with lyrics to come up with the songs that I wrote. And so that was the key to my early songwriting and singing career. It was being able to play so well on guitar and being able to write songs that way.
Wow. Now, Jimmy, did you ever play guitar on any of your recordings?
Actually, I did not. Once in a while, I would do a little thing over an overlay.
Uh-huh.
But I really did. What happened was, by the time I was a major star, if you want to call it that, in 1958-59, known everywhere, I came into the boss's office of the booking agency, and they said to me, they said, Jimmy, they said, you've got all the talent, you've got it all together, but there's one thing we have got to get you to do. We have got to get you to learn how to be an entertainer, to where you can move around on the stage and utilize your hands, and just standing up there playing guitar is not going to do you justice. And so they really pushed me about that, and eventually I saw their point. And so I put the guitar down,
right,
and really tried to learn how to be an entertainer who was not just a stand-up song singer with a guitar. And so eventually, because of that, I just pretty much put the guitar aside as far as an entertainer on stage went.
And being an entertainer on stage, that is an art all in its own, isn't it?
It really is. I found out real fast that anybody could be a record act. See,
mm-hmm.
Say, well, here comes so-and-so on stage, and you can tell who's a record act because they get up there and say, hey, we're so glad y'all are here, and remember when we did this, and then they'll sing that song, and then they'll get through with that and say, and remember when we did this, and then they'll do it two or three times, and then they take a bow and walk off. Well, I learned something interesting. I'll never forget this. I was out in, out of Idaho at a big show with a car show and everything, and I was asked by the promoter, They said, Jimmy, so-and-so plane cannot make it. Can you do an extra 20, 25 minutes on stage? And so I thought about that. I didn't have time to teach all the guys all the songs. So what I did was something that turned out to be a major, major discovery. I got up, and when I would do my songs, I would tell little tidbits and little, I would take little stories mm-hmm. behind the scenes of my songs. And I would take little stories of behind the scenes of the artists that I worked with and knew so well. And I put together a 40-minute set with that. And the thing is, when I went back out, I didn't forget this. When I went back out to the table where we sold merchandise, I had the longest line of people wanting to talk to me, get an autograph, buy a product, whatever.
Wow.
And one after one was telling me the same thing. Quote, he said, oh, Jimmy, we love your stories. And I'm telling you, the light bulb went off. I never forgot that. And so I began to incorporate all of the knowledge that I have. I'm going to say something here. It's humbling, but it's true. Of all the artists around today, the ones that you would talk to, not probably less than 3% started at the very, very beginning when I was doing all the early, early shows with Clyde McFadder and Thurston Harris, a little bitty pretty one, Laverne Baker. I'm talking about the people before even the Dick Clark and Alan Freed days. This mm-hmm. was really the early, early days. And so I got to know all of these people. I got to know Alan Freed on a personal basis. I got to do shows with all of these early, early people. I got to do shows when segregation was still big. I've had so many stories, it'll give you goosebumps. And so I'm probably one of the only remaining ones that was really at the first of how this all started. And so my stories all connected with all of that. I could go on for hours and not tell the same story twice. Wow. It was just remarkable, you know. And so it's enjoyable when you get an interviewer who wants to hear some of that, you know. And you're one of those that loves.
I want to hear it all. Yeah, I want to hear it all. Now, I got a question for you. On the road, traveling on the road, I mean, back when you were on the road, people weren't using big jets and all that back then. Was it hard, Jimmy, on the road, uncomfortable?
Well, thank God, you know, you're 19, you just turned 20 years of age, and so it was not as hard as one might think, mainly because we all traveled by, you know, the Greyhound tour bus, and everybody got along. And so every one of them, I mean, we all entertained each other. Before you know it, we're from one place to another. Mm. Now, I'll admit, it got to a point where after a while that you didn't know where you were. You didn't know what town you just came from. I mean, you were on the, we were doing this 7 days a week. And here's the other thing. Back in 58, early 59, when you really would look at how many in number, how many artists that were well known, how many records they had made, because there was no internet, no YouTube, the only way you knew who was anybody who did any song was through the radio.
Right.
And then from there, you know, here and there with a TV thing, but it was the radio. Everything was the radio. And I would say probably in 1958-59, in total number of well-known artists. Now, remember, this is before the British invasion. This is just America.
Mm-hmm.
When you looked at the total number of well-known, recognizable songs by well-known, recognizable names, there might have been 35 in total number. That was it.
Wow.
That was it.
Wow.
Yeah, and I was one of those. So when we would get to a town, It was like the town shut down because there was nothing else more important than that show that night at that arena. And I mean, it was amazing, you know. It was truly, truly amazing. Football wasn't a big thing.
Right.
Sports couldn't compare. It was the rock and roll, and it was the artist of that era. And I just was blessed to absolutely just be exploded into the midst of it. And so it helped to be a nice looking kid as far as the girls, I'd admit that, you know. So so we drew a lot of fans. We drew big crowds.
Well, it didn't hurt either that you had some great records, and your records sounded really, really good. I can remember now, talking about these things, I can remember as a young teenager, in the morning, my sister and I would get ready to go to school, and my parents had this little radio that sat on the kitchen counter, and we would turn it on as we were getting dressed and had our breakfast, and we would listen to WBBF in Rochester, New York. That's where I grew up.
Wow.
And then at night when I came home from school, the radio would go back on. I would listen to a fellow by the name of Nick Nixon, who did his Bandstand show, and he would be playing all the hits of the day. And
wow.
Then, Jimmy, we would wait for Saturday night, for Dick Clark's Saturday Night Show, where the great artists of the day would lip sync to their to their tunes. And I'll tell you, that's, so I can see where you're saying the 35, because now there weren't a lot of you.
No, there really wasn't. And okay, Sandy's getting a call over here. The thing is that I stayed very popular. My songs stayed popular. And it was, you know, I had such a good rapport. Like I say, Alan Freed was not only a promoter that wanted me on shows, he loved me. I, without any question, I was his favorite white male vocalist. His favorite black male vocalist was Jackie Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
And every show that Alan would put on, he would fly me and Jackie Wilson in a day or two ahead of time for us to hang out with him. We would even be on the radio with him for hours, and we'd just all be, you know, just shooting the breeze and talking about things. But then, of course, that, in just out of the clear blue, one night at the background of a show, Alan came by backstage to me, and he said, "I'm getting ready to go to Hollywood to do my rock and roll movie." And he told me a little bit about it, and he said, "I'd like for you to play the lead." So that's how I got the lead for his rock and roll movie called Go Johnny Go.
Yeah,
a friend of mine, Alan Price, who does major interviews and plays music down in Dallas, he has come out and said without any question, because he knows so much about it, he said, "Go Johnny Go was the most iconic rock and roll movie ever made."
And that's what I read also. Yeah, so that's that is quite an accomplishment. Wow. Let's go up to the days when you were actually a DJ. You were a DJ in Pennsylvania, right? And I got a question.
I never called it really. I called myself a DJ. What happened was, I had moved to Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, and I was doing a lot of shows. I would drive to New York. I would drive all over this part of the United States, you know, and do shows, do one-nighters. And so I would only do that on the weekend. And so a fellow named Bob Stevens, he was an acquaintance of mine, and he sold airtime. He sold advertising on the radio, and he called me. And he said, "I want to tell you," he said, "there's a little station that's been bought, and they've turned it into totally an oldie station." He said, "Would you ever consider," he said, "just coming on and doing like specialty type interviews and give your stories about all the artists that you recorded with and all that. And so I entertained that. They made me a very good financial offer. And I said, well, the only thing is, I said, you know, I'll do it maybe a couple of hours in the late morning and, you know, off in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. He said, hey, if we can get you to do it, period, that's fine. And so I agreed, and I actually did that. And so I called some of the artists I know. I got a hold of Frankie Avalon, and I recorded a special with him, interviewing him. And then I called my friend Brenda Lee, and I did a special on her. And so I did that kind of thing, and I did it for, not too long, maybe a year. And then eventually I heard that the station was going to be sold, and I'd kind of gotten tired of doing that anyway, to be honest with you. But yes, I did do that for about a year.
Now, in the movie Go Johnny Go, Joanne Campbell was in that movie also, right?
Yes, correct.
Yeah. Now, do you stay in touch with the people that were in the cast that are still with us?
Well, first of all, people have to realize that when I was on set in Hollywood, and I would introduce somebody, let's say I'd introduce Joanne Campbell,
mm-hmm.
all of the people, all of the artists, they had already filmed their segment on a soundstage in New York previously.
Okay.
So none of those artists were really in Hollywood with me live. They were already pre-recorded. However, I had done several road shows with Joanne Campbell, so I knew her very well. But here's another thing. People used to think, and a lot of them still do, they think that we artists, that we all are one big, happy, jovial fan club buddy program,
yeah.
and we all stay in touch, and that's totally not true.
That's right.
In fact, all of us, we would all be buddies on a show, and when that tour was over, we always went our separate ways.
Uh-huh.
And I never was in touch with, on a first-name basis, a buddy-buddy get-together with any of my fellow artists. Now, when I was on tour, probably my closest friend on all the different tours was Jimmy Beaumont with the Skyliners.
Oh,
Jimmy
yeah.
and I were really, really, really close friends.
Great singer.
And Bobby Darin and I were good friends on tours. And really, Clyde McFadder was a very, very close friend of mine on different shows. And that's pretty much the long and short of that. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think what happens a lot of times, Jimmy, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that people that are not in the business, that are not entertainers like yourself, we sort of think that you are like a family, and we don't understand a lot of times that you are individuals, and this is your career. This is what you do for a living, you know, and you entertain us. And after a gig or something is over, or a movie, that you do go your own separate ways, right?
That's absolutely right. And I was still living at home with my parents in Baton Rouge, and so I would, no matter where I was and whatever engagement I was in, when I would get through, I would fly back, and I'd go back home to Baton Rouge, and I had the same guys that I grew up with. They were my buddies, and my golfing buddies, my fishing buddies, and that's the way it was. I will like to tell this one story that I'm so proud of.
Okay.
I could see it like it just happened. After Just a Dream had come out, become such a huge, huge seller, I never realized how this was going to hit me, but I can remember like it was 5 minutes ago. My mom said, there's some mail for you. And this is about September, after my record, Just a Dream, had come out the previous April. And inside that envelope was a check made out to me from Ace Records. Now, this is 1959. Right?
Mm-hmm.
When I got the check. 1960, maybe, okay. And I got this check, and I looked at that check, and it was made out to me for $10,000.
That's a big chunk of change back then.
Can you imagine what $10,000 in 1960 would be equal to today? And I'll never forget, I was so happy. I found a contractor, and I had him go to our home in Baton Rouge, and I had him totally remodel and flip that house to where added additions to it, made it into central air conditioning. I mean, totally bricked all the way around. I totally redid that home for my mom.
Wow.
And I'm telling you, that was the best thing that I ever did with one penny of any money I ever made. And so it was a moment for me that I'll never forget, you know. And
wow.
To say the least, my mom was beyond thrilled, you know.
Oh, I'll bet you, Jimmy.
Yeah.
Now, you also served some time in the U.S. Army, correct?
Yeah, I did. And in fact, it was interesting. While I was in the Army, I was, in no time at all, the commanding officer found out who I was. And this happened in Fort Linderwood, Missouri, and he said, "What would it take for you to get together with and put together a little band that you would play for one of our officer dances and so forth?" And so it didn't take me long to figure out how to agree to that. I said, "Well, you know, a 3-day pass would really be nice." He said, "Oh, well, we can arrange that." So we did this little dance music for this officers club thing. Lo and behold, within 3 months, he's coming back to me, and he said, "We really want to do that again, Jimmy. Well, you know, run a 3-day pass." I said, "No." I said, "What we really need to do for me to do this is you put together 2 3-day passes back to back." "Oh, man, Jimmy." I said, "Yeah, that's what it's going to take."
Uh-huh.
He said, "Okay." So he agreed to me, and I called my booking agency in New York, and they booked me, and I made $1,000 for doing 5 songs. I flew up to Canada, in fact.
Jimmy, you should have asked him for another stripe. You probably could have got that thrown in, too, you know.
But it's interesting also that after I got out of the Army, I called Johnny Vincent. And I said, "Do we have anything that I recorded that we never put out?" I said, "Because I'm out, and, you know, it'd be wonderful to at least let people know I'm back."
Yep.
And he said, "Well, we only got this one song, and it was kind of a throwaway song that you did." And I said, "Well, whatever it is, let's put it out." And so he said, "Okay." So we put it out, and it got to the top of the charts probably faster than Just a Dream did, and that was the song Venus in Blue Jeans.
I love that song. I remember when that song came out, and I said, "My goodness." In fact, Jimmy, I have that 45 on the yellow Ace label and the white Ace label. So I got them on both labels. I liked it so much.
Wow.
Depending which color I wanted to play that day. That's a great song. Now, I read that the Army stint came, you know, as your career was really, really going. Now, did that slow you down, in your opinion?
Actually, only temporary, because once I got out with Venus of Blue Jeans, I mean, I was right at the top again and on every major tour all over America again.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of a little hiccup, but it sure didn't mean anything once Venus came out and became such a gigantic hit, you know?
Yes, a great, great tune. And, you know, a lot of people may not realize this, that you charted music all the way through 1969. So let's go from 1958 to 1969. That is a span of 11 years that you had songs on the Billboard charts.
Wow. I did not know that.
Yes, you did.
Wow. Interesting.
Yep. And I'll tell you, you had so many great tunes. My Own True Love. Wow, what a classic that is.
Thank you.
And the B-side, That thing should have charted too. Little Boy in Love. What a great song.
Thank you.
Goodness.
That is a favorite of many, many fans, Little Boy in Love, yeah.
Well, you know, Sandy and I were talking, and I told her, you know, Venus in Blue Jeans is definitely one of my favorites of yours, but there is a song of yours from 1969 that I'll tell you, I could play it with my headphones on and just go absolutely bonkers. And that's a little thing called Curly. I love that song.
That song was interesting. I had a fan come through a line to just at a meet and greet where a show I was playing out in California, and he shook my hand. He said, "Jimmy," he said, "what?" He said that you did a song. He said called Curly, and he said I'm from Fresno, and he said it was number one for many, many weeks in Fresno, California. Curly, number one.
Wow.
I went, "Whoa! Well, thank you."
Wow. And you also did a great version of A Million to One. Great song.
Well, that song, it's amazing. When I heard that song originally, I thought, man, that's a Jimmy Clinton song. It really is.
Now, yep.
That should be a Jimmy Clinton song. I mean, wow. I wish I'd got it first. But then I decided after I was doing an LP, I decided, you know what? I'm going to do that song because I loved it. And I really felt I nailed it. I really did.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I was playing it earlier today.
I heard you. Yeah,
yeah.
Thank you.
And you did a great job on Matilda.
Well, that is such a swamp pop. That's the national anthem of the swamp pop Gulf Coast down there. Absolutely. Matilda, yep.
Jimmy, is there any song? No, I mean, I'm putting you on the spot here. Is there any song that you turned down that you wish you didn't?
You know, really, no, because when I would check out songs, I was treated like royalty when I would walk into a publishing house, because they automatically figured that if Jimmy Clinton records this, it's going to be heard and we're going to make money off of that song because Jimmy sang it. So I never had that to happen, really, not ever.
Wow, that is fantastic. And you know, you had an album that is out back a few years ago. Everybody Needs Love is the name of the CD. And
Yeah. You
did a great remake of Just a Dream on there, along with some
other...
Well,
I decided to do that because the technology of music and recording was not the greatest back there and right when I recorded it. And I decided, you know what? I would really like to redo it with good technology and good recording equipment. And so, yeah, I'm glad I did that. I re-recorded Just a Dream.
Now, before I let you go,
okay,
how can people get a hold of your music? Do you have a website that they can go to and purchase your music?
Well, thank you. You know, I never remember to mention that, and I should. I have really a million-dollar website. It's jimmyclinton.com, and anything to do with my career from the beginning up to today, there's insight information, and there's so much innovative work done on that website, and everything that somebody wants to know about my music, about different pictures that were taken. There's even a guest book where people can make comments, and eventually I get over to reading those. But they can also order any of my music, my CDs, even my DVDs that I did of some one-man shows. That's all available at jimmyclinton.com. Yep, sure
great.
Is. Thank you for that.
Well, yeah, you're welcome. I'm going to check that out myself. Yeah, that is great.
It's an incredible website. It really is.
Jimmy, I thank you. This is the third time that you and I have spoke, and I have enjoyed each time more than the last. So,
well, thank
you. You can't leave
well,
me hanging.
It's been my pleasure, and you know, I'm just happy that when someone calls to interview Jimmy Clanton, they're going to find out that this guy has a lot of knowledge of the era of music that he represented, and it's been an incredible journey for me, and the good Lord has blessed me. I still have my voice. I'm still able to get up on the stage without an oxygen tank.
There you go.
As long, yeah, I will. You know, I will turn 82 years old September 2nd.
God bless you.
Yeah, and to still be able to do this, and do it well, I'm so happy, and I thank God for that.
Well, I hope that when this COVID and everything is over with, that we'll be able to see you perform live in concert again.
Well, thank you so much, and it's been my pleasure, sir.
Jimmy, thank you. It's all, like I said, it's always an honor, and you are one of the pioneers in this industry. I mean, you were there. You were there in the heydays. You were there at the beginning. I mean, when Elvis burst on the scene, it wasn't too much longer till Jimmy Clanton burst on the scene. And for
you know, that's very humbling, because that's hard for me to digest. Yeah. But I've been told this several times, like you, that Jimmy, you were at the start.
Yes, you
really were.
Yes, you were.
And so it's been a wonderful ride.
And it's not over yet, my friends. Not
well,
over.
Thank you. And again, those of you that are fans of Jimmy Clanton, thank you. You all are the reason that I ever started writing songs, that I ever started singing, that I ever started doing live shows. If it weren't for you all, I've said it so many times, there would have been no reason for me to record and write songs, because Sandy, my associate, she will tell you, I don't listen to myself. She plays my own songs a lot around the place, but I got to walk away. I've heard Jimmy so many times, I'm not exactly going to sit around all day, every day, you know, and listen. But,
you know, you and
I appreciate the fact that I've been able to write good songs that I like, that I love, and have a voice, you know. As I used to put it, and I wrote this myself one day, I said, you know, I create and then I illustrate.
Yes.
I write the songs and then I sing them.
You know, Jimmy,
and that's fun.
We do have something in common, you and I. All right. When I sing, my wife walks away.
That's good.
Jimmy, thank you.
That's good.
Thank you, my friend. God bless you. And hey, let's do this again sometime down the road, okay?
I would love to do that, sir. Thank you so much.
Bye, Jimmy. Bye-bye.
Bye for now.
Seven wonders in the world, but what they say is out of date. There's more than seven wonders in the world. I just met number eight. My Venus in blue jeans is everything I hope she'd be. A teenage god.
I trusted you for such a long, long time. And now you're telling me bye-bye. So what'll I do? I'm so blue. I trusted you. You call me on the phone.
Hey, what a great interview with Mr. Jimmy Clanton. Wow, I'll tell you. Enjoy it every single time I get to chat with him. What a fantastic artist. What a fantastic person. And I hope that you enjoyed it also. We're going to put this together. We're going to put it out so that you can listen to the interview again. All right? And I'm going to close things up right now from the interview part. And I will be back with you tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time for Joe T's Soda Shop, the Wednesday edition. Again, thank you all for tuning in. We really, really appreciate it. God bless.
Just a dream, just a dream. why do I love you? How can I live in misery? I know that I won't forget you, but now I know it's too late for me.